on a Thursday. Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. How you doing?
Yeah, folks, how you doing? We hope you're doing well. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Cherry's co-host. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY, where today our main topic is going to be Albert Barnes. Mm-hmm. Pretty good chance you've been to the Barnes Foundation, which today, controversially, is on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. An amazing art museum, Cherry. You've been there, right?
It's really nice. I love it.
It really is a one-of-a-kind museum. Mm-hmm. It's a one-of-a-kind collection. It was amassed by this guy, Albert Barnes, who's from Philly, grew up in poverty in South Philadelphia, mm-hmm. made his money with this sort of miracle drug, and then spent a lot of his money collecting art.
Yep.
He was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And there's a new book, a new bio all about Barnes called The Mavericks Museum. Cherry's got a copy right there. It's a fascinating read by Blake Gopnik, who is our guest today on the show. And look, you're not a big art person. I'm not a big art person.
No, like, yeah. But I like art.
I'm not deep in it. And yet I still love this book because one of the things that it makes you think is sort of like, what type of personality, what type of person kind of sees the future?
Yeah.
Like, what does it take? And it seems like in Barnes's case, one of the things that allowed him to see the future was his total consuming hatred for the elite culture of his day. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy just had a fire that would not go out. And so it's a great read. I'm really excited to talk about it. If you have questions about Albert Barnes and the history of the Barnes Foundation or comments, or you've been to the museum, you want to talk about it, hey, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or hey, on YouTube, Studio Tubers.
Hi, Tater Tots.
Drop a comment in the chat.
And today, friends, is Thursday. I mentioned that at the top of the show, which means it's DJ of the Day. So you have to send us your on-theme song suggestions for the end of the show. You can email them to studio2@whyy.org. And the theme of the day is
art.
Contrarians.
Yeah, contrarianism.
Controversies, possibly.
Yeah, museums.
Museums, yeah.
What else could we get to? I guess pharmaceuticals?
Yeah.
Because that's how we made his money?
That is.
So yeah, you submit a song, and if your song is picked by Producer Paige, welcome back, Producer Paige.
Yay.
You will get a shout out at the end of the show, and we'll play your song. Again, 12:30 is the cutoff. Email those song suggestions to studio2@whyy.org.
So we have our trio of news stories, and I have the first one. The Trump administration has frozen $175 million in funding to the University of Pennsylvania over the school's, quote, policies forcing women to compete with men in sports. Those words come from a tweet from the White House's Rapid Response X account. The funding pause follows the president's February 5th executive order threatening to remove federal funding from universities that allow trans athletes to participate in women's sports. If you recall, Penn sparked controversy when the school allowed trans athlete Leah Thomas to compete on its women's swimming team. She set several records and won titles through her final season, which ended in 2022. Before transitioning, though, Thomas competed on the men's team back in 2019. And that case is what prompted the Trump administration to launch an investigation of Penn for alleged violations of Title IX last month. Now, I'll mention that this funding freeze is not related to that investigation. That's according to White House officials. It's instead part of efforts to review discretionary federal funding to universities. Discretionary funding to universities. Penn, by the way, is the largest private employer in our region and receives about $1 billion a year in federal funding and could lose all of that funding depending upon the outcome of that investigation into Title IX.
$175 million. Penn's one of the biggest employers in the region.
Yep.
So this is not trivial. I mean, this
is a big deal.
It's a big deal. I am frankly confused because Leah Thomas, as you mentioned,
is no longer there.
Mm-hmm. All of these policies have since changed. So what is the policy that they had was in compliance with the NCAA at the time. The NCAA has changed its rules. So there is no, like,
if this Leah is like Thomas a retroactive is, punishment almost. If and this is according to their tweet.
That's quite
is,
a precedent
it's
to
a retroactive.
Set.
Yeah.
It's quite a precedent to set if you are supposed to anticipate what future rules are going to be and your federal funding is contingent upon that. That would be quite a precedent to set.
Absolutely. And this freeze has drawn strong criticism from Philadelphia City Council member Jamie Gauthier. And while others, including the Penn swimmer who sued Penn, Riley Gaines, has celebrated the move.
Mm.
So controversy there.
All right. Let's talk about moldy weed now. So there was a secret.
What a transition.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a secret shopper who was testing pre-rolled cannabis joints in New Jersey. And this investigation revealed that there was significantly higher levels of yeast, mold, and bacteria than legally permitted in 7 of 25 tested samples. This was an outside independent group that did the testing. There's a story from the Asbury Park Press all about this. But apparently more mold in these joints than expected, and they tested the THC, and the potency was often less than advertised. So some of this New Jersey weed that's hitting the market ever since they legalized weed is maybe not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I mean, part of the argument for having legalized cannabis is that it's safer than what you would get on the streets, right? And especially when you talk about medical marijuana, I mean, you're thinking this is actual medicine for some people. So you should know what's in the medical marijuana. And so this, I mean, it just seems like you're going to have to, cannabis, you know, labs, you're going to have to step your game up if you really want to be selling medicine.
New industry, maybe a little bump in the road here for a new industry. And obviously, you know, one of the selling points for legalized recreational marijuana is that when you went to your, you know, black market dealer, mm-hmm. you didn't really know what you were getting.
Yeah, you didn't know what it was.
Yeah. Well,
it was in a baggie.
Yeah. We're supposed to know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's
not
what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So this did surprise me a little bit. And I, you know, maybe we'll be hearing more about this in the future.
Yeah. They're cracking down a little bit.
Speaking of the future.
I know.
It might be less organful.
We'll see. Yeah. It's the end of an era. As you know, the downtown Macy's inside of the old Wanamaker building will officially close this weekend. And they will do it in style with all day performances on the iconic Wanamaker Grand Court. Oregon.
Dun, dun.
I know. Thank you. Peter Richard Conti, who has been the Wanamaker Grand Court organist since 1989, he will join a steady parade of organists who will perform hour-long free recitals beginning at 9 a.m. Saturday, ending around 6:30. Mm. And this organ has been around for decades. I mean, the organ has been played twice daily, 6 days a week within Macy's.
Wow.
And the event will be the lead into the final closure of Macy's doors at the close of business on Sunday. Now, it's unclear right now, Avi, what's going to happen to the Wanamaker organ. It's so big and massive. I mean, parts of the instrument are tucked into the building.
Right.
Itself.
Right. You can't like airlift it.
You can't
it.
Like just move it. Yeah. So luckily, TF Cornerstone, which owns part of the building and is expected to acquire the rest of it, says it plans to keep the organ. But, you know, it's the end of an era. I mean, I would go there for their Christmas concerts.
Are you going to go to this concert on Saturday?
I think I'm going to pop in. I probably won't be able to see the Grand Court organist play.
Yeah.
But I want to at least pop through and hear a little bit of the organ and, you know,
I'm not gonna
maybe
be
post
here this
about
weekend.
It on IG.
Could you take a video for me? I would love to see it.
Yeah.
I do, you know, end of an era. And this goes into this broader conversation we've been having about that building and Macy's closing and, of course, the future of Market East, which has been in the headlines for all sorts of reasons. And so, yeah, I do think there is this is wrapped up in so many things, but mostly it is really wrapped up in, you know, nostalgia. People have just a deep attachment to this remarkable instrument. There's really nothing like it in the world. And it happens to be here in Philadelphia. So, you know, it's just sad. And I think in that way, and, you know, we will wax nostalgic about, I think, this organ for a long, long time.
I know. I hope we get to hear it again. But Saturday, 9 to 6:30.
9 to 6. And you'll be there. You just promised.
Yeah,
everybody.
Yeah, I know. I said it on the radio. So it must happen. I can guarantee
must.
A pop in. I can definitely do a pop in.
Hey, if you ever popped into the Barnes Foundation Museum on the Parkway, we'd love to hear from you this hour because we're talking about its namesake, Albert Barnes, a fascinating and at times infuriating character. And he is the subject. Yes, a lot of contradictions. He is the subject of a new biography called The Mavericks Museum by Blake Gopnik, who is our guest on the other side of this break. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. Or hey, if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat. And as we go to break, Cherry.
Yes, we're closing with a performance of Festive Entry by Rudy Lucente, the longest continually serving assistant grand court organist for the Wanamaker organ. Such, so beautiful.
Take us away, Rudy.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Folks, have you visited the Barnes Foundation, either the one on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway or out in its original home, Marion, right outside Philly? Well, millions of people have walked through the art galleries and marveled at Albert Barnes's collection of Impressionist, Modernist, and African art, which he displayed alongside door hinges, keyhole plates, and other ironwork pieces. It's a fascinating collection.
Yeah, he definitely has a unique eye for art and in many ways was ahead of his time, collecting painters like Cezanne, Renoir, Matisse, and Modigliani before most Americans recognized their value. He was also pugnacious and a contrarian whose life started in poverty in South Philadelphia in 1872.
And this week marks the 100th anniversary of the opening of the Barnes collection to the public. And yes, there is a brand new biography out by our guest, art critic Blake Gopnik, titled The Mavericks Museum, Albert Barnes and His American Dream. Blake, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
We're so pleased to have you in your hometown of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So welcome home. We want to hear your questions at home. And your comments about Albert Barnes, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, a Studio Tuber, drop your comment right there in the chat.
So, Blake, congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
And one of the things that surprised me was Albert Barnes has saved all his writings, his notes, his correspondence, and you got the opportunity to sift through it all. When you were going through this material, what sort of struck you about Albert Barnes such that you felt you wanted to write this 400-page book?
Everything struck me about it. I mean, I'm what they call an archives rat. I just love digging through someone's papers. So if you ever want me to go through your papers, I'm happy to do that for you. I fell in love with this guy. He was just so full of contradictions. You get these letters, these incredibly kind letters to the people he employed, to African-Americans that he preferentially employed. He was the kindest guy, except when he was the worst person on the planet, when he was tearing people to shreds. You read these letters, these just utterly vicious, hilariously vicious letters to people who, you know, he had minor disagreements with. So it's those contradictions, you know, that he was this great inventor, collector, really someone who helped American life. And then on the other hand, could just be out of control maniac, you know, going after people who did even the slightest thing that he didn't like or approve of.
Can I just, I collected, as I started reading this book, I just started underlining quotes from letters that he had written because they were just so crazy. I just want to read a few of them so that people at home just get a little bit of a taste. So this is something he said to his one-time business partner who helped make him rich. I would have been justified in shooting you down like a dog.
I remember that line.
Here's another quote. You are what psychologists term a mental delinquent, variously known to laymen as dumb bunny, false alarm, phony. He wrote that to the president of the University of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
I mean, explain how this fire was lit in Albert Barnes, because I couldn't produce that prose, even if I tried.
Yeah, I mean, I think the chip on his shoulder, he had two chips on each shoulder. I mean, the guy was completely out of control. I think it came from his youth. I think it came from the fact that he grew up in a neighborhood that really doesn't exist at all. People in Philadelphia don't even know it once existed. And that was what was called the Neck.
Yeah, take us down to the Neck.
It was a swamp in far South Philadelphia. Really, a big chunk of what we now think of as South Philadelphia. You know, there were no cheesesteaks. There was mud. And he ended up there sort of in his sort of mid to late childhood. And it was just a nightmare for him, I think. And that sense of being hard done by, I think, and having to fight back. I mean, literally as a kid, he had to teach himself how to box so he wouldn't get the hell beaten out of him. I think that that was always there for him, that he always felt he was a kid from the Neck who had to fight the entire world just to get ahead.
Yeah. For people who might not know, like if you go down what the Neck is today, like if you ever gone to a Phillies game or an Eagles game or some areas a little bit north of that, like where the highway runs through, that was all swamp and slums, and that's what he grew up in. I mean, it's crazy to think about.
Even north of there. I mean, surprising how far north the Neck went. That's where he grew up. The thing is, it's not where he started growing up. Yeah. He was in a slightly better neighborhood before, and then in Kensington, in North Philly. Mm-hmm. And then things got bad. His poor father lost his arm in the Civil War, took a bullet to the chest as well. So he never really recovered. He clearly had PTSD. That's what we'd say today. Mm-hmm. Became an alcoholic. And the family just tumbled into the worst neighborhood in probably in all of America. I mean, the Neck was, people came for slum tourism. They'd come to see just how bad it was. You know, rich people would slum in the Neck. So that's what he grew up with. And I think it affected his whole life.
So let's take us back to that time when he grew up, because he loved his mother, he adored his mother, and she was deeply religious. And part of her, you know, her love for religion and the trips that they took every summer to these revivals sort of really impacted and changed him. Tell us about the time and then sort of that tie to religion.
Yeah, I mean, when he was growing up in the Neck, there was a local Methodist church that his mother went to. And it's important to recognize that church was very activist, was all about helping people. So that got into him really early and mattered later. But then in the summer, I mean, you know, we have air conditioning now, but Philly is hot enough in the summer now. Imagine what it was like and how much it stunk in the summer in, you know, the 1870s, 1880s. A lot of people would go out to these camp meetings, which was a real escape from your, you know, the drudgery of your life as a poor person in Philadelphia. And you'd go out and you'd find God and you'd find friends and you'd sing and you'd be ecstatic. I mean, it was that kind of ecstatic religion. And it's not clear that Barnes ever cared about the religious side of it. Mm-hmm. He's clearly an atheist by the time he's a grown up. But the cultural side of it, the aesthetic side of it, really touched him. There's something really magic going on.
He loved the Negro spirituals that were sang. And this was a mixed race gathering, which was very unusual for that time. Because for people who may not remember or not even understand what it was like in the 19th century in the Philadelphia area, could you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is America is way too segregated now, but of course it was more or less legally segregated. Philadelphia was a very, very racist place, as all America was after the Civil War and well into the 20s. But there were certain contexts, especially a church context, especially at these meetings where black people and white people would end up finding God together. And they would often come together just at a certain point in the meeting. So they'd be segregated and then they'd come together. And surprise, surprise, the African-Americans had a slightly livelier, more interesting way of doing things. And Barnes really took to that, really realized there was something deeply creative going on in the singing, not just the singing, but the whole religious experience. And that touched him. He said later that really changed his life, that it woke him up to aesthetics writ large, to aesthetics, you know, being, as he said, you know, something you could live every day. It wasn't just pretty pictures. It was something more important than that, something that was really profoundly part of your life.
Mm. And so he has this aesthetic awakening, but at the same time, his schooling and his career track takes him into the sciences. And what I found interesting, what I expected, because I knew he'd gone to Central High School, the great public high school here in Philadelphia, and then on to Penn. And I expected that he would really have a reverence for the education that he got at those places, because that's kind of what lifted him out of poverty. But it didn't seem like that. It seemed like he also not held a grudge, but kind of poo-pooed the education he got at those places. So talk to us a little bit about the education of young Albert Barnes.
Yeah, it's funny that he never really celebrates that side of things so much, even though he's a great progressive. And he's part of something that I think too many Americans don't know about, which is the progressive movement from, you know, 1895 to 1915, something like that. It really changed the nation. The nation was, you know, living the Gilded Age, where rich people were unbelievably rich and poor people were very poor. I don't know if that rings any bells to you. That was our first Gilded Age. And the progressive movement really tried to get us out of that and had a real effect, right? Yeah. Public institutions were being founded. The Central High School is really kind of the progressive movement before the progressive movement existed. It was a way for poor, smart kids to get a great education, as it still is, for that matter. And without that, you know, what would Barnes have become without having gone to Central High that spotted him? You know, he was in a terrible little local school, elementary school, and yet it was clear he was talented and passed these rigorous exams and got to Central High and then to Penn for med school.
Yeah.
But, you know, he didn't like any kind of establishment.
Yep.
He didn't like
even the ones that helped him.
Yeah.
That's what's so fascinating. Like you say, there is, it's so hard to envision a path for him into the elite, to this amazing art collection without Central, and yet he still has a problem with Central, and sometimes for good reason, because people did look down on him there.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the kid whose pants were too short and were ripped. You know, he was, you read the high school newspaper and there's some pretty nasty little references to him, you know, asking who's going to treat. They said that that was his battle cry, was who's going to treat, right? But this was, I mean, there must have been other kids just as poor, but the truth is he was definitely on the poorer end. Most of the people at Central were, by the standards of the time, modest. That is, they were tradespeople or even, you know, real estate people, whereas he was really deeply, deeply poor. And from the neck, everyone would have known that he was from the wrong part of Philadelphia. But also, I think that's important, is he always wanted, as part of the progressive movement, even when, you know, just a kid didn't even know what that was, he wanted things to be better than they were. Everything had to be better than it was. And that's not a way to be liked or even to be nice, right? Constantly telling people they're not good enough is not a nice thing to do. And he did that every moment of his life, always telling someone you're not good enough because you're not doing things my way. His way was the best way. And if you didn't do it his way, you were doing it wrong.
Never the critic.
He had a lot of strong opinions. But he went to medical school, decided pretty early on that, you know, he was not suited to be, you know, a practicing physician. And he decided to develop, he got into business, the business side, and pharmaceuticals were blowing up. Everybody was coming up with these remedies. And he came up with one. Explain what it is and how this made him a lot of money. Because this is, he was a one-hit wonder.
It was, he had one other product, but it was basically a one-hit wonder. And people tend to beat around the bush a lot about what it is he invented. He invented an antiseptic, an important silver antiseptic. Remember, this is before antibiotics, right? So the only way to treat a bacterial infection was on the surface. You had to kill it with you know, an antiseptic.
And he invented, to stop it at the source, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he invented one that used silver. There were other ones that used silver at the time, too. Silver is a good antiseptic. He invented one that killed the bacteria without causing you all sorts of pain. The problem is the other ones were super caustic. So it killed the bacteria, but it killed a lot of your cells, too.
But this was for STD.
This, I was about to get to that.
You know, I want to throw that in there.
It was, interestingly, not, it was for gonorrhea, and it could be used for normal adult gonorrhea, as it were. Try to stay polite here.
Yes.
But mostly the most important thing is, right, in the days before antibiotics, babies were born coming through the birth canal and could get gonorrhea from their mother and get it in their eyes and go blind. There were just tens of thousands of infants who went blind. Nowadays, they put antibiotics in both a drop in each eye automatically. Well, what happened is his antiseptic was particularly good because it didn't damage the eye in the process of killing the bacteria. So it became, in many states, it was mandatory to put an antiseptic drop in each every newborn's eyes. And his was the antibiotic of choice, or sorry, the antiseptic of choice. And that's what made him his money, is that all of a sudden drops were needed all across the country. Now, it was also useful for cuts or, I mean, he claimed it could cure anything.
And he was great at marketing, and the company really grew, and he was able to make, a lot of money.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is he never, once the company grew to supply the sort of normal demand for this product, he never grew it more than that. He really left money making behind. He said, I'm just not interested in making money. It's not that exciting. Yeah. You know, he could have grown the thing. He could have found other products. He could have, I mean, let's be frank about this, because I'm frank about it in my book. His marketing consisted often in bribing doctors to write journal articles. Now, the stuff actually worked. I don't think he had to do that.
Yeah, and, he used to, you know, cook the books on that.
He did. Mm-hmm. He was an aggressive person in every way, including the marketing, but the product worked and was important. And then rather than make more and more money, he decided that he cared about art. And that's the beginning of the Barnes Foundation, is when he decided art was the most exciting thing he knew.
Yeah. Before we get to the art, though, I do want to talk about his business a little bit more, because you're right. Like, he didn't want to become like a pharmaceutical titan, kingpin, but he did take a keen interest, at least at one point in his life, in how his business was run, because he saw that as a representation of a new way forward, of his egalitarian values. So let's get into that a little bit, because you do get a sense of his personality in the way that he ran this factory in Philadelphia that was producing this antiseptic product. How was this factory run? How was it different than other factories?
Yeah, that's really important. The product was called Argerol, and it was being made. This is sort of weird. We can't quite figure it out. On the grounds of the Powelton Hotel in North Philly, which the building's still there. It's one of these amazing Victorian buildings. It was only, I think, 10 years old when he somehow got a chunk of it to run this factory of his. I mean, factory. It was a tiny place. It had like 12 employees.
I'm overstating it here. Yeah,
it was enough to make this product, which was pretty simple to produce, but really importantly, most of the employees, all of the people who did sort of the practical work, were black. In an era where factory work was considered too good for black people, right? Mm-hmm. Black people were supposed to be shining shoes, were supposed to be, you know, earning a penny at a time doing, you know, carrying goods from spot to spot. And he gave them real factory work with real salaries, with real pensions, with, you know, he took care of their health. He helped them buy houses. This was not normal for a white boss to do for his black employees. And the employees in his in the back office were all white women. So it was not considered acceptable to mix white women and black men in a factory. And in fact, he was both, you know, anti-racist and a feminist. He always had, all of his lieutenants were almost always women. So he's really interesting. For such a difficult person, he had really some pretty great progressive values.
Did you think he realized at the time? Because he seemed like he realized it later in the art world, and we'll get into the art momentarily. But I just wondered, do you think that at the time he realized what he was doing? And it seemed intentional, but did he know that it was impacting race relations by making these moves?
Oh, I think absolutely. It was, again, his way of telling the establishment to get lost, right? Yep. This was not what you were supposed to do in Philadelphia. This would have definitely raised eyebrows. And it's important to say that, you know, I've heard people say, oh, well, he did it just to get cheaper labor. He paid them more than the average white factory worker earned, let alone what the average black worker, because black workers were paid much, much, much less for the same labor as white workers. So he really, you know, there was a larger movement of workforce improvement in the country at the time. The National Cash Register Company was famous for it. But he went further than most of those companies. He really believed in treating his employees well, and they loved him for it. There's a clear sense that his employees, you know, he was a boss. And he, you know, you had to do what he said, but within those limits, he really treated people better than most employers did, I think. We've all had terrible employers, and I don't think he qualified.
Yeah, which is crazy. The guy that wrote those quotes that I talked about earlier, who seemed to just pick fights with everybody for sometimes no reason, also happened to be a good boss. I mean, the contradictions go on and on and on. So I'm going to read in a few comments that we're getting from our audience. Yeah. As we transition toward the art part of this conversation, Judy on YouTube says, I've been to both Barnes locations. Wonderful experiences. I'm so glad that the new modern building was still set up in the same way inside. And Yelena says, I went a few times on school trips to the Barnes Foundation when it was out in the suburbs. You couldn't buy a ticket in advance. The number of people allowed in was limited. The art teachers that came in with us weren't allowed to teach us about the paintings while we were there. They would have been thrown out if they were caught. So we'll talk a little about people's memories and realities and match those two up. But Blake Gopnik, before we finally get into the art, we do have to talk about the fact that now Albert Barnes is making a lot of money. And what's he going to do with this money? And it seemed like early on, he actually did think, like, I want to be part of the nouveau rich. I want to fit in, which is weird when you, in retrospect, you're like, what was he thinking in that moment? But when he first moves out to the suburbs, it seems like he kind of wants to be maybe a sort of normal rich guy.
I mean, the crazy thing is he buys horses. He joins the local hunt.
Yes.
You know, he wears the red clothing that huntsmen wear. I mean, it's kind of sad, actually, that he spends a ton of money on horses. And of course, you know, everyone at the time more or less knew how to ride. But to ride for the hunt, you got to really know how to ride. He apparently was the most aggressive rider and fell off all the time and didn't mind getting back on those horses. It's kind of sad, his effort to become part of that, you know, the mainline high society. And it's clear that was never going to happen in any real way. They let him spend his money. They let him buy trophies for the local hunt, you know, local races and things. But he was never going to really become part of them. And I think he realized that. He also spends money on cars, on amazing Packard cars. I don't even drive. But one of my favorite things in writing this book was digging into exactly which cars he owned, because all the receipts are there. All of his letters telling the people who were selling him cars that the cars sucked and that they were all idiots. And I mean, he went after them. I feel so sorry.
He did not bite his tongue.
Oh, my God. Anyone who sold him a car, because he complained, you know, the day after he gets at home that he's been ripped off. Just terrible. But the cars were gorgeous.
And he got new cars on a regular basis.
Constantly.
Sure.
Every year. He didn't like a car that sounded old, you know. And remember, these cars were pretty primitive machines. They probably sounded old pretty fast. Yeah. And they were hard to drive. Yeah. I mean, I don't drive. Actually, I do drive, but as rarely as possible. You know, now their cars are easy to drive. Those things were a beast to drive.
Yeah. And so how did he decide, you know what, I'm going to start collecting art? What was the hook that drew him in?
You know, I think it was slow. He's clearly starts buying the stuff that a rich person's supposed to buy, kind of decorative, not too challenging, kind of romantic art for the walls, what everyone else was buying, art that was 20 or 30 years out of date, you know, according to the serious art collectors. And I think what happens is what happened to lots of people. Art, you know, I'm an art critic. I'm going to say this, of course. Art has, for some people, kind of magical attraction.
Yeah.
Once you start looking at it more seriously, you know, it's easy just to wander through a museum and kind of really not look that much. But if you start really looking and asking it questions, it gets you. It really can get you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's especially when he starts collecting modern art through this friend of his called William Glackens, who himself was an important modern artist.
And he went to Central with William.
Went to Central with William. And I think that being around William and the other friend, John Sloan, two men who become important artists, really makes Barnes realize that art is special. And then, of course, modern art is part of his hatred of the establishment, right?
It fits right in.
Yeah, especially at that early moment, right? Yep. He starts collecting in 1912, where Americans and Philadelphians are using the word impressionist, right? A word that's 40 years old, to stand for modern art. They'll say, I hate that impressionism when they're talking about Picasso.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So even though some of the work he collects seems kind of tame to us now, at the time it was, I mean, he does a show in 1923 of his collection and he gets ripped to shreds for it.
We're going
to
get into all of that.
We're getting into the juicy part.
Because you're going to have to understand how people in America viewed this type of work to understand how revolutionary Barnes was. We're going to talk about that with Blake Gopnik on the other side of this break. His new biography about Albert Barnes is called The Mavericks Museum. Much more to come on Studio 2. Stick with us. And welcome back, listeners and art lovers, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you are just joining us, we're talking with art critic and New York Times contributor Blake Gopnik. He's the author of a new biography about Albert Barnes, the eccentric philanthropist and art collector who, of course, gave us a local institution, the Barnes Foundation. We're uncovering a lot of unknown history about his life and his dream of changing America's highbrow art scene.
If you have questions about Albert Barnes and the history of the Barnes Foundation, you can send them to us. Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're watching on YouTube, drop your questions in the live chat.
Yeah. And Avi sort of alluded to this question before the break. But I want you to sort of set the scene of the art scene in Philadelphia and in across the country, right? That sort of where Albert Barnes was situated that made him stand out? Set the scene for us.
Yeah, you know, 1912, Paris has been, you know, just the center of the art world for a long time, doing pretty radical art. I mean, stuff that doesn't look radical to us, like Monet or Renoir, was really revolutionary when it came along. And there was one movement after another. You get, you know, Van Gogh and Cézanne, all this happening. Not so much in Philadelphia, right? In Philadelphia. I mean, I think it's hard for us to remember that Philadelphia stood as the home of American aristocracy. Philadelphia was the fancy town, right? I think it's really lost that now. You know, there's the other side of Philadelphia, the sort of working class Philadelphia that dominates our image. But, you know, once upon a time, this was where the Blue Bloods were. And the Blue Bloods weren't too fond of radical new kinds of art. And they dominated, you know, there was no museum. The Philadelphia Museum of Art didn't exist yet, but they dominated the art world. There had been good artists in Philadelphia. Cecilia Beaux, fabulous artist. But that, especially when Barnes starts collecting around 1910, it's not a great place to be looking at radical art. And this friend of his, William Glackens, who lives in New York, is from Philly but has moved to New York. You know, again, by our standards, his work looks pretty conservative. But he's at the center of this group called the Ashcan School. And they're really socially conscious artists. They're making pictures of poor people, of, you know, the bad parts of New York. So they're really an interesting avant-garde. And and he's the man who makes Barnes realize that art can be exciting, art can be different, and art can be anti-establishment. Mostly that art can help him piss off Philadelphia establishment.
It's a tool.
I mean, he genuinely loved art. Let's not get this wrong.
Of course,
he
of
didn't
course.
Only collect it to piss off the establishment, but boy, was that a nice, you know, side effect of collecting this art.
Well, it's a perfect nexus for him, because you write in the book, Barnes's taste was at least as much about championing the rejected as about celebrating the merely excellent. So he always had a fun. He was an egalitarian at heart. He had a fondness for people who were looked down upon. So that's great for collecting modern art. It also helps that while he's rich, he's not Rockefeller rich, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. He's not Carnegie rich. And so these are the artists that he can afford, because the competition, you wouldn't believe this, for a Matisse or a Cezanne is not as hot as some of the classical painters, right? Can you explain
he's not even
that?
Wanamaker rich.
Right.
He's
not
got one little factory.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's important to realize that at a pretty early on, all of the money starts going to art. And as soon as he founds the foundation, you know, gives it its charter in 22, really all of his stock in the company goes to the foundation. Really everything goes into this museum, this collection.
A little bit left over for cars, but mostly art.
Yeah, mostly art. And, you know, he builds when he builds the foundation that opened in 25, those buildings, the administration building is basically a mansion that he lives in.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't treat himself badly ever. and there are tax dodge aspects to everything he does in life, including the foundation. But he believes in the art and he wants it to be seen. And yeah, it's way cheaper than buying, you know, an 18th century British portrait, let alone a Renaissance painting or, you know, a Leonardo da Vinci, whatever. You know, things have weirdly reversed in the last 20, 30 years. People spend a fortune on a Jeff Koons, a Damien Hirst. The latest art is often the most expensive art. You know, Andy Warhol has a record for the most expensive art sold at auction, right? Almost, I guess, $200 million.
But that's a new phenomenon.
That's new. Yeah. That's new. Contemporary art used to be cheap. People thought he overpaid. The first time when he bought a little tiny Cézanne, a beautiful little Cézanne sketch, basically, at an auction in Paris in 1912, the press goes crazy. Like, how could he have paid so much for this piece of modern crap, basically, is what they're saying.
And also, people are deeply offended by some of the stuff that he's collecting and displaying, right?
Yeah.
Offended by in his collection?
You know, it's funny. Everything and nothing. They're offended by the fact that it's not realist art. Isn't that weird that people get so angry about the look of a piece of canvas with some paint on it?
Yeah.
But, you know, he had this show in 1923 of his collection, and the press goes insane. Yeah. Right? He spends this money on junk. Some locals call in these doctors, these quack psychiatrists, I guess you'd call them, who say that the artists are clearly diseased, and they imply that they must be gay. I mean, it's really, they go berserk over these pictures.
But he did support women artists. He supported LGBT artists. He also supported African artist buying African art and then shoved the African art in the faces of the elite collectors. I mean, tell us about that and how he sort of helped change the game when it comes to celebration of African art specifically.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I pretty soon when I was researching the book realized I had to begin it with this insane moment, 1924.
Yes.
He's invited to the party that launches the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? It's, you know, there's a bunch of white people. They're invited because the black establishment wants to show them how good black culture is. But he gives what's clearly the most interesting talk at this party in March of 1924. And it's all about how African art not only is good, but is at least as good, if not better, than the art of ancient Greece, the art of ancient Egypt, right? He says that even the modern artists he loves so much are a derivative of African art. I mean, it's an amazing, amazing celebration of African art, which he'd only been buying for about a year at that point. And it must have been the biggest collection. I mean, the people who bought African art almost always bought it as curiosities, as anthropological material.
Yeah.
I mean, Penn had a collection of anthropological material. But he's one of the first people to collect in depth, thinking, no, this is art. Yeah. This is art that's like the art that I'm loving by
Picasso.
For
aesthetic appeal, yes.
For aesthetic appeal.
Mm-hmm. Just reversing a bit, you mentioned those doctors who savaged his collection at that show. This is what he said about the doctors. They should be seized by the state and put in a place where they cannot pervert public morality. You attack Albert Barnes, he's going to punch back with
a
haymaker.
He'll come with it.
Yeah, and not just one quote. I mean, he went after them for paragraph after paragraph after paragraph.
So then we get to this moment 100 years ago where the Barnes Foundation becomes open to the public's weird way to phrase it, because it wasn't like you could just walk in. But, you know, there's some opening to it. And people at the time said, like, this is basically the first modern art museum in America. I mean, MoMA didn't exist, right?
Not for another 4 years. And MoMA doesn't get its own building for 14 years.
Yeah.
MoMA's in, like, the top of a little office building, basically.
So this thing is, it is truly one of a kind when it opens 100 years ago, right?
Yeah. Think how hard it was to see modern art. Where would you go to see modern art if you wanted to? If you were crazy enough to want to look at this stuff, where would you go to see it? The suburbs of Philadelphia came to be the answers. This was, and he would pay people to take trains to see it. I mean, he was less of a curmudgeon early on than he becomes later, but always, there's always someone that he wants to have see it. You know, some actor that he loves. He's a funny character. He doesn't hate everyone. He just, when he hates someone, he really hates them.
And one of the things he wanted to do was to educate people. It was part of the mission. It was baked into the DNA of the Barnes Foundation. Can you talk about how he wanted to help people see art? And he actually had a method for doing that.
Yeah. I mean, let's go back a little bit to his factory, where he actually started having seminars for his factory workers, some of whom weren't even literate, about the latest ideas in philosophy and, you know, the latest literature. He had great books on the shelves. And you know what? It was normal at that time for people to work 10, at least 8 hours a day. But he said, you know what? We can get the work of the factory done in 6 hours. Let's spend those other 2 hours of the day thinking together, reading together.
It was
just amazing.
Speaking of philosophy, he forms relationships, deep personal relationships, with lots of really important thinkers of his day. And we have a caller on line one. Mm-hmm. This is Bill from Bryn Mawr, who has a question for you about, I believe, one of those philosophers. So, Bill, you're on Studio 2. You have a question for Blake Gopnik. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Just wanted to hear about the connection between Dr. Barnes and Bertrand Russell, two real contrarians of the 20th century.
So you write about that in the book. Bertrand Russell's in there. Maybe I shouldn't give it all away, but can you tell a little bit about their relationship? I mean, at one point they had a very close relationship.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is early on, one of the books that Barnes is teaching to his factory workers in the teens of the century is Bertrand Russell. He loves Russell, and they have a little bit of a correspondence. He just thinks Russell's the greatest thing ever. In 1940, Russell kind of gets stuck in the United States because he can't go home to England, where he comes from, because of the possibility of submarine attacks on any boat crossing. This is the Second World War, right? So he stays, he gets a job. Bertrand Russell gets a job at the City University of New York. And at this point, he's especially famous for his views on sex and love. And they were not traditional views. He believed to a certain extent in free love. He said that, won't get the quote exactly right, but something like that the, you know, women, wives are dislike sex more than prostitutes do or something like that. Yep. Sorry, I've mangled that quote. And he gets fired from his new job, or he never even gets to take it up because the local Catholic bishop, you know, makes a fuss. And Barnes says...
He gets canceled.
Basically. And he gets canceled. He gets totally canceled for his views on love and marriage. And Barnes steps in and says, well, if they won't pay you, come lecture for me. Yeah. Come and lecture in my foundation in the suburbs of Philadelphia. It gives him a nice big salary. Everything's going incredibly well. You know, Bertrand Russell was Lord Russell. He was a super fancy aristocrat. So that should have probably... Russell should have realized this could go wrong, right? Yep. Barnes does not like fancy people. But Russell was also the most important philosopher, one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. Brilliant, brilliant guy, and a rationalist, a great rationalist, and a kind of anti-establishment figure, whatever. Everything's going great. Russell is giving his lectures, which become his little history of Western philosophy, the most important, you know, layman's guide to philosophy. Everything's going well. Russell's very young wife apparently seems to have kind of high-hatted Barnes. She liked her title of Lady Russell. Maybe. She actually seems okay to me. The letters are really sweet. Barnes starts bossing her, saying how she should raise her kid, how she should, you know, her kid has some breathing problems, just telling her how to live her life completely. And she pushes back a tiny bit, which was a big mistake.
Yep.
And Barnes starts going crazy. Eventually, he used the excuse that she was knitting in her husband's lectures, which she actually helped prepare. She had a big role in preparing these lectures. Apparently, she was knitting, you know, like socks for war veterans in this.
And
in
that
this,
was her great offense.
And that was her offense. And he kicks her out. And eventually, he uses that as an excuse also to fire Bertrand Russell. And then there's a lawsuit and Russell wins and makes lots of money off of Barnes.
Wow.
But what started out so well, so often with Barnes, ends up dying.
He had a lot of friendships that went south.
Yeah.
I want to read this question from Katie, who says, what compelled Dr. Barnes to display art with pieces very close and arranged symmetrically according to size, along with antique locks, as opposed to the traditional way? And we only have 3 more minutes, so if you can keep that answer brief. But that was a big part of his legacy. He kept things a certain kind of way, even though it did change from time to time. Explain why.
Yeah, the ironwork, the antiques and everything come pretty late in his life, in the 1930s. So it wasn't central to his idea. We think it is because we see it. You know, the truth is he liked buying stuff. He was bitten by the antique bug, bought all this stuff, realized, uh-oh, what am I going to do with it all? And then folds it, you know, in a serious kind of way into his theory that what mattered in art was what it looked like, not its subject matter, not what it was about, what it looked like. So he would compare an old key to something in a modern painting and say, look, they're the same shape. So that's why they're hung the way they are. In the end.
Yeah. And I know it was hard to get in sometimes. It was a lot going on at the original Barnes Foundation.
Yeah. And before he died, I mean, he sort of held the keys to the gate, and he would accept people and reject people seemingly for no reason. He sounds in many ways like a tyrant. And you get into this question reading the book of like, and it's so reductive, but you can't help but ask yourself, am I reading about a good guy or a bad guy?
Yeah. You set the answer is yes. Exactly. The answer to that question is yes.
You set that tension up in the first page of the book. Yeah. You know, it's like he's in this place, launch of the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. He has these really positive ideas, but he's also like ready to be arrested that night. I mean, how do you try to answer that question? Good guy, bad guy, and sort of the value of being a contrarian in the world.
You know, I can't answer the question. What's great is that both things exist at the same time. That's what makes them exciting. That's what made writing this book so much fun is that. But, you know, we're all full of contradictions. Sure. I've never met a nice person who didn't in some moment or another, you know, act badly.
But he lived them so loudly.
He was free with his thought, his word, and he was generous. Right. It was just so much wrapped into one person.
I mean, I'm an art critic. I'm all about polemics. So I'm less uncomfortable with that than some people. When I was a young art critic, boy, was I mean. So I understand the pleasure in just saying what you think.
Yeah. Well, we have to wrap it up there, but you should go out and read the book. It's called The Mavericks Museum, Albert Barnes and His American Dream, by Blake Gopnik, who is a biographer, art critic. He's also, by the way, speaking tonight at the Parkway Central Library at 7 o'clock. So you can catch that talk. Blake, thank you so much for your time. And thank you for this book.
Ah, what a treat. It's nice to be back in my hometown.
Absolutely. Yeah, welcome back to
great
Philly.
Having you here. So DJ of the day.
All right. So let's cue this up. Mm-hmm. I don't know this song. I'm very excited.
I don't know this song either.
So the winner, our DJ of the day, is Susan B. from Powhatan Township, New Jersey.
That's all right.
Who chose a song that our producers say is
a banger. I'm like, that's a strong word right there. Go ahead.
It's from 1975 by an artist called 10cc, and it's called Art for Art's
Let's
Sake.
Hear this.
Let's hear
this.
A little bit. You like that?
I can see why producer Paige said banger, because a little drum beat.
Yeah, it's got something.
It's got a little bass line to it.
By the way, producer Paige is Paige Marie Bessler, one of our great producers here. We also have Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes, also great producers. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. And Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Art for art's sake. Love it.
And we love you. We'll talk to you next week.